a young perspective on hot-button issues around the world. This is The Hub.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Wang Guan in Beijing. The two sessions, China's annual key political event, was all about sending a positive and reassuring message to the doomsayers and to the world. China is on track to achieve high-quality development, it says, and release new quality productive forces to spur its growth. Will it be enough, though, to allay fears in the European Union, China's biggest trading partner after the U.S.? How can China and the EU find the middle course and veer toward a more balanced and mutually beneficial approach? Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Adam Dunnett. He's the Secretary General of the European Chamber of Commerce in China. Adam, welcome to CGTN. We've just had the Chinese political season known as the two sessions. We've heard from the Chinese premier saying the Chinese economy will grow around 5% in the year 2024. A whole host of measures trying to help doing businesses in China easier for foreign companies. You're representing the European Chamber of Commerce in China. Anything from this year's two sessions that's sticking out to you?
Well, from a business investment perspective, there was a section particularly on foreign investment, and the first opening part of that session talked about increased market access in the areas of telecommunications and in healthcare. So that immediately caught our eye. There was no further explanation of that, but we expect relevant policies to be coming forward in the future. So that was the most immediate one. But in that whole area, there was general talk about increased market opening and attraction of foreign investment, something that obviously we encourage as well as a European chamber operating here in China.
How do policies in China transpire into benefits for foreign companies? I mean, usually there is this CITPP, the trade facilitation body that is associated with the Chinese government, that, as far as I understand, get in touch with foreign companies in China and then help interpret and facilitate policy implementation. What do you expect to happen next?
The Lianhui is extremely important because it sets out a broad framework for the year ahead, but it also builds upon a number of policies and meetings that have taken place previously. Obviously, stability is the core focus. Through stability, we will see progress, as the report said. But what businesses need here is they need transparency and predictability. And so for a lot of the objectives of the work report itself, we saw areas where it did speak about reform and opening up, but we also saw areas that spoke about self-reliance. And so to be very clear here, my view of this is in some areas, China will continue to open up and reform, but in some areas, it wants to have its own domestic industry. It wants to have self-reliance. And so what's extremely important is for us now to go a step further and to try and understand what is meant by these broad directions and how it will affect different sectors accordingly. And then particularly in the area of digitalization, I need to stress that this is the future. And for us, what's really important is understanding what China's security related legislation, how that's going to be implemented. So the definition of important data, for example, how data can be shared globally with its headquarters through cross-border data transfer arrangements. All of these things need to be recognized and they need to be spelled out more clearly for businesses to take advantage and to better understand the intentions of the work report this year.
Right. Adam, in 2023, the European Union prioritized a so-called risk mitigation approach towards China. We've heard about it once and often. Despite this, China-Europe freight trains exceeded 85,000 trips in the year 2023. If you look at Germany, German direct investment in China set a record at 11.9 billion euros in the year 23, growing by about 4%. What do you make of all this at the background of, the noises that says, China is not investable, foreign companies are pulling out?
Okay, there's a lot in there. First, on risk mitigation, you're right. European Commission President von der Leyen last year had a famous speech on de-risking. And indeed, globally speaking, many countries are increasingly concerned about economic security. But I think it's extremely important to understand how this is being played out in various economies. So in the EU, the term that was coined by the EU is indeed de-risking. De-risking here doesn't mean decoupling. It doesn't mean anything towards China specifically. The way the EU has explained it is to take a country-agnostic approach in a very refined and detailed way to look at areas where there are potential risks to its economy to ensure that its supply chains can remain resilient. And when I say country agnostic, let me give you an example. In the area of critical raw materials, for example, they have a new policy in place which says that no more than 65% of specifically identified critical raw materials should come from any single one country. And so in this case, it's not about domestic development internally. It's not about excluding any specific country per se, but it's about ensuring diversity and access to these materials. Again, the EU approach is very much focused on diversification. The approach that we've seen in the US is more targeted towards China. And then China's response has been about developing its own capacity internally, domestically, which has been the case for a long time already. So very, very important to understand that going forward.
Right. Adam, what key measures do you think should be optimized further for foreign companies? And then do you see opportunities or synergy between Chinese companies and European companies going forward?
It's a new term, but actually I don't think it's a big change from China's previous goals of trying to further move up the value chain and improve productivity and bring in advanced technology. China has made tremendous gains in the last few decades and is a very innovative environment. So European companies do want to be here. They want to innovate alongside their Chinese counterparts. They've got technology that they can bring. They can also learn from their competitors and their partners here. But in order for this policy to be successful, I think it's important to understand you can't just demand technology gains. You can't just write it into a policy and expect it to happen 12 months later. You need to create the environment, the soft environment in which companies and individual entrepreneurs are willing to take the risk, knowing that the risk that they take and the financial input they put into such investments has a return, has a market, has IPR, intellectual property rights that will be protected, and is able to do so in an environment that's a fair environment. That doesn't mean that subsidies need to be ruled out completely. Subsidies are there to help innovation, but they need to be understood and they need to be applied equally and selectively as well. Getting that right balance is very, very challenging. And again, for companies and individuals, it's about creating that environment for them.
Right. And then, Adam, I want to get your stance about the Chinese economy, the 5% growth target. There has been so many theories going around that says China peak or the China model is running out of steam. Do you see 5% as a realistic target, and do you see that happening in the year 2024?
Well, China's always been able to deliver on its almost always been able to deliver on its stated targets, and last year was a surprising 5.2%. This year is going to be very challenging. Last year, we were all amazed with the quick rebound that China had in January and in February after it released its COVID measures, and production got going almost immediately. But what the surprise was is that the demand wasn't there. And that's been a featured element of the concerns about 2024 as well, is both domestic and global demand just isn't there. And so we've faced a situation where we've got overcapacity in a lot of sectors, and we've got a real mismatch between supply and demand. China's also facing, obviously, a huge demographic challenge right now with an aging population, youth unemployment, with 12 million graduates graduating this year. And you've got a restructuring of the industry here. We're moving into a lot of new industries, a lot of old industries are being replaced now. And making that transition, as needed as it is not easy. And so we need to make sure that we've got the right policies in place to elevate and to encourage consumption, because savings rates are very high because people are uncertain about the future, but also providing market opportunities for business so that they make the right changes that the economy needs. And again, that they're incentivized to do so with a market that's there that will reward them.
Right. Then in the year 2024, what new opportunities do you see for the European Chamber and the companies that your organization represent? And what are the key challenges? Previously, you talked about IT and then a few sectors that is potentially opening up to foreign companies. What sectors and areas do you see as more promising?
Well, I just mentioned the aging population. So there's so much that can be done there with China's Healthy 2030 agenda. Many European pharmaceuticals and medical device manufacturers and healthcare providers are willing to play their role and make contributions to the development of these sectors and needs here in China. I think there's good opportunities for them there. As I mentioned, this is one of the areas where China said it would loosen some of its market access constraints. I think anything related to the environment and China's 2030 and 2060 decarbonization goals, its 1+N strategy is something that needs to be rolled out. And there's many companies here that want to make investments in green energy, but they need to know what the policies are going to be at a national level, at a local level, and a sectoral level. So a guide map for how China is going to get to that 2030 peak period and that 2060 neutrality goal is needed. And I think one of the more immediate issues that we're seeing is European companies here, they've got to comply with both Chinese regulation and EU regulations. And so in the EU, we've seen the development of the EU's Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive. That's going to come into play very, very soon. And companies here are going to be responsible for their supply chain up and down the ladder, going to China, going back to Europe. And for them, being able to have access to green supply chains, access to green power, green electricity, is extremely important. So many of our members, many of the meetings that we're having now, we're meeting with officials at a local level, and we're pleading with them to make more investments into green energy, to allow us to do so, and to allow us to have access to the grid so that we can be compliant both with our goals and requirements here in China and back in the EU. And what I say here actually applies very much to Chinese companies as well. We're all looking to go green, and so we need to work together on making that happen.
Right, Adam, finally, considering the fact that the China-U.S. strategic rivalry is not going away, is not dying down anytime soon, do you expect closer coordination and a greater potential between China and the European Union in general going forward?
The de-risking approach that the EU has is very different from the U.S. Obviously, we all need to work together, and countries will respond to what different countries do in terms of opening their markets and closing their markets. We've seen that between China and the US is tit for tat for protectionism. This isn't the way we want to go. We've seen good cooperation on environmental issues, both amongst all three economies that you just mentioned. Last year, we saw an agreement signed on AI, on artificial intelligence. This is extremely important going forward between the U.S., the EU, and China. So that's a very positive signal that we can work together. Overall, our trading relationship of all three economies is our first and second largest partners. So it's extremely important. And I think we shouldn't lose sight of the overall benefits that those trade investment relationships have for each other. We would like to see more European companies investing here, and we'd like to see more Chinese companies investing in Europe as well.
Adam Dunnett, the Secretary General of the European Chamber of Commerce in China, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you.
For more on China's main growth drivers in the year 2024 and its path to modernization, earlier I had a conversation with Michele Garacci. He's the former Undersecretary of State at the Italian Ministry of Economic Development, responsible for international trade and investment. He spent some 10 years in China, where he worked as a macroeconomist and professor of finance in various universities. Take a listen. Professor Garacci, thank you for joining us again. It's great to have you on The Hub here on CGTN. Let's talk about the Chinese economy. There are many theories going around these days, mostly concerning the prospect of the Chinese economy potentially peaking. This China peak theory has been very popular, saying that the Chinese model of growth has finally run out of steam, and given what happened in the last couple of years, the Chinese economy probably will never go back to its heydays, let's say. Do you agree with that prediction? What is your sense of the Chinese economy now that you have been living in China on the ground for many years?
Thank you for reminding me. We have to remember that there are some economists, analysts, even famous, that have been predicting the collapse of China for the last 20, 25 years. We have some famous books come out in the year 2000, and then on and on. Everyone, many Western analysts, predicting the end of the China model. And I want to say two things. First of all, the interesting thing of the China model is that it adapts to the situation of the time. So in a way, some of them may be correct to say that that was the end of the China model, but they did not predict that China would introduce a new model of development that would continue to give the country a very good, reasonable growth. So we should think of China model as a series of models that take into consideration the situation of the time, domestic, international, and adapt with the goal to continue a certain level of growth. So we analysts, we should not talk about China model, but rather a evolving Chinese model, almost like a Darwinian that adapts itself to the challenges of the time. Then, of course, if you refer to the heydays when Chinese growth was 9-10% and even more, those are gone. But let's not forget that even a 4 or 5% growth for the future out of a higher base, it is even larger in money terms than a 10% growth of 15 years ago when the base was much lower. And it is a natural economic process. The growth rate do not stay at double digit or high single digit, but subsidized to middle single digit. So in my view, a growth of 4-5% for the next 5 years for China would be very, very good.
But talking about what's happening right now to the Chinese economy, you know, household consumption has been sluggish compared to many developed countries. What are your observations regarding the stimulus packages China has implemented over the past couple of months to stimulate its economy? Do you think it will work?
I think it may work. It is challenging. Tourism is the easiest one that we observe over the last few weeks, and indeed is showing signs of being at a level which are higher even than the pre-COVID 2019. So it seems that we have passed these 3 or 4 years of COVID. On the other hand, however, the consumption is challenging because consumer confidence after these 3 years of various challenges, domestic, international, COVID and so on, restriction, lockdown and so on, it is low. And it is natural that it is low because consumers need to regain that trust. The real estate and the stock market do not help because even if the value of investment in the stock market does not represent a large proportion of individuals' wealth, the perception that people do, domestic consumers, is that if the stock market goes down, it's an indication that the future of the economy is not very good.
But how do you think the Chinese consumers can pick up confidence in their economy, in society, whereby they can safely and surely spend more?
They can make it easy for example, tax reforms for companies so the profit could increase, some subsidies in the industry that are also strategically important, so that this Shanghai index starts to pick up again. And then the other thing is the real estate market, of course, which is a form of saving. You know, people, you want to people to consume. So we need to tell them what to do with the money. They can either spend or can they either consume. And again, the real estate is very important for the wealth factor. When people think they are rich, even if it's a nominal wealth that is on paper, they do spend more of their income. And finally, overall trust in the future. Now, what I think the Chinese government is doing very well in this difficult international situation. You may find that the Chinese situation is challenging for consumers, but you should come and see what happens in Europe. We have wars, we have governments that do not deliver to the people. So in relative terms, I think the Chinese government is doing the best it can without interfering too much in the market, because then it will give the wrong impression that China may move back towards a more closed, more state-run economy. The other thing that I would do is very easy, to open up for foreign investment more. This is going to be a big boost of confidence for foreign to see that they can play in the Chinese market, they can make investment, they can acquire company, even in sectors that a few years ago maybe have been considered by the Chinese government to be sensitive or strategic, and so not open to foreign investment. But we have moved on over the last few years, and what was strategic now maybe is less strategic today. And so there could be some open up. Again, it is not just for the money, because we know the inflow of foreign direct investment into China is not determined, but it's the impression that China is open, interact more with the market, and consumers would feel that then they can play a better role too.
Yeah, that is a fair point. But what sectors are you thinking that China can perhaps start by allowing in more foreign investors that were previously not allowed into those sectors?
The one I work in, education. We seem to be going a little bit back to close a little bit more with foreign universities for various reasons. I think this is very important, especially for young consumers, I would like to see flourishing of international campus or various international universities, more and more of those. Because if you tell the young people, 18, 19 years old, that there is this base of cooperation at academic level, then they would know that on top of that, there could be opportunities also in the business areas. The other one is technology. We do know now that China is almost as advanced as other countries, as Korea, as the United States in semiconductor. I think allowing minority stakes, not controlling, but a few percentage point ownership in some of the Chinese big tech stocks would actually be very beneficial for the economy. You cannot give foreign control of Huawei or SMIC, but a small ownership. And the same for energy. 1 or 2% in oil, gas company, that does not change the way that the company is run, that would also be beneficial, because it's all about building consumer confidence and building the understanding that China is open to doing business with the rest of the world. And that, I think, is the unique position of China today. While other people do worse, if China can tell its own people and the world that it's open again for business, and if also, that would be good.
Professor Geraci, you talk about the real estate market that has seen price decreases for up to 20-30% in some major Chinese cities. And you made a very fair point whereby you said, with property prices being popped up, those property owners will have a sense of ownership. What can be done at this point to really, let's say, salvage, if not salvage, but really help the property market in China?
You can do a few things. You can do low mortgage rates for young couples who are the ones who are not able to afford the houses today. Cheap loans, even zero interest rate loans, I don't know, for the next, for the first 3-5 years to young couple who get married, who have children. So at the same time, you incentivize and you try to change also the demographic challenge that China has with declining population. Young people now cannot afford houses in general. So you need to make it cheaper and almost interest rate free until they get to a good level of income, and then can they start repaying it. That would help. We can also do something, but it's a bit too tricky and need to be careful, to increase the loan to value ratio so that people can maybe buy a little bit more with the borrowings. And then I think the other thing that needs to be done is a implementation of a less restrictive migration policies. Because at the end of the day, the real estate market is also driven by the migrants, of course, low-income people, but at the base of this pyramid, they do need to go and live somewhere. So if we don't have migrants, we lose 10, 12 million people, new city residents, and therefore that also pulls the market down. We estimate that the migration rural to urban contributed to do about 0.5-0.7% of GDP growth, all coming from direct real estate and indirect effect. So that is important. And in that way, it is also good that the Chinese government does this urbanization in the rural area. So instead of having people moving to the city and coming from rural areas to Shanghai, they actually urbanize the home country so that the distances to travel is not so much. And those houses should be relatively cheaper and therefore more affordable. You know, for the high-end market, the people who have two or three houses, really, so be it. You know, if you speculate on the real estate market, you should be able to take a loss. I believe also the Chinese leadership has made it clear that houses are for living, not for speculation.
And then what do you think can potentially be the new growth engines of the Chinese economy? We've been hearing about this dual carbon goals and also this AI that is taking center stage in many sectors and across many areas.
I do believe technology has always been one of the main engines, and it's one of the four components of the GDP. We cannot increase people, we cannot increase land, we cannot we can increase capital, but the thing is innovation and technology. So I do think the growth engine will be in innovation. China, and this is very little known maybe to foreign audience, is almost getting at par with Silicon Valley in California and other innovation hub in London and in Berlin, Germany, with private equity. We need to develop that because that's the engine to fuel this innovation. So a lot more needs to be done in the venture capital and private equity. It cannot just be the government that finances a large company, but we need this as an ecosystem of small, medium enterprises. And AI, indeed, is one of those that will completely change the dynamics of the industry, and it will make it more efficient, although we need to be careful because AI also has some high risk of displacing labor force, and we are seeing this already happening in Europe.
Professor Chiracci, always great to pick your mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that will do it for this edition of The Hub. Thank you so much for tuning in. Our news coverage continues on CGTN. Bye and take care.